You're listening to the GNU World Order, episode 31 of season 12, for 2018, July 29. In today's episode, I want to talk about a couple of things, but primarily the topic that I sat down to this episode thinking about is the concept of evaluation. But first, before we do that, let's talk about some listener feedback. I got some good listener feedback. I got one from Furoshu on Mastodon, and he says, just a note on the book recommendations at the end of whichever episode it was where I was talking about Lua. Oh, 26, episode 26, season 12. And he said, a good starting point is the book called Programming in Lua, which is, and it's the official Lua project book. So if you go to lua.org, which you probably did immediately after episode 26, if not even sooner, maybe you did it during the episode because you were so excited about starting with Lua. But if you go there, you'll find in the documentation section that there is, oh, actually even on the front page, I just now noticed, fourth edition of Programming in Lua available. So if you click on that, it takes you to a place where you can purchase the book, either as it's the fourth edition as of recording this show, and it was released in both hardback and as an ebook. So you can even buy it just as an ebook and read it wherever you want. And ebook formats include EPUB, Mobi, I guess just online reading, and PDF, if you want to call that an ebook. Really don't like calling PDFs ebooks. But there you go. And the advantage of buying that book is, well, first of all, I guess it's an official book from the project, so you should probably feel pretty confident about what it says. But the purchase of it also goes to support the Lua project, because they're the ones who own that, they're the ones selling the book. I mean, you get it over Amazon, it looks like, but according to Furoshu, at least, some of the proceeds go to the Lua project. Next bit of feedback I got was from a guy named Mr. Matt, also on Mastodon. I'm getting a lot of feedback from Mastodon lately. And Mr. Matt says that he noticed that the RSS feed only goes back to the beginning of season 12, and he was wondering if, or I got the impression, rather, that he was kind of wondering if there was a more sort of global, you know, all-inclusive RSS feed, and of course there's not. Now, the origin of that story is that a long time ago, like back in, 2008 or whenever this show started, people used to complain about RSS feeds that were too long. I'm not 100% sure why that was a problem. I don't remember the details. I feel like it had something to do with feed readers downloading by default just everything in a feed, and it would be difficult to then stop it from trying to download 100 or 200 episodes when all you really wanted to do was add the feed and get the latest episode. These days, that doesn't seem to be as much of a problem. It was never a problem for me. I never had whatever issue other people were seeing, but today, it seems less of an issue, and people are fine with big feeds, and I subscribed to several shows with just enormous feed history that goes all the way back to the beginning of their show, years and years and years in the past. So I don't think it's that big of a deal. Some people maybe did at one point. I'm feeling like maybe that's tapering off. If you, dear listener, like you, the person listening right now, if you have an opinion one way or the other on that topic, feel free to let me know via email or Mastodon or, oh, hey, I'm on Jabber again. So that's, let's see what that is, because it's either Klaatu or not Klaatu at 404.city. Yeah, it's Klaatu at 404.city. So that's where you can find me via Instant Messenger if you're using that, or of course IRC. Next bit of feedback is from DODD Dummy in IRC, and also on Mastodon actually as of late. But he says that he claims to have told me about this a long time ago, although I have to admit, I forgot about it. I think he did tell me, and then I think I forgot. But then when I was about to use DD, I think there was this inkling of an idea in my head, and I thought, didn't I find out something about seeing progress? And so I looked at the man page, and listen to this. DD, the command DD, which is, what is it, disk duplicate? I don't know what DD stands for. No one knows. It's something that no one can ever be sure what that means. I'm sure someone will actually write in and tell me. Whatever DD stands for, I feel like I did know what that stood for at one point. But anyway, dd, if you do, you know, you do your normal dd command, right? Dd if equals foo.img or raw or whatever it is, of equals slash dev slash blah, and then status equals progress. Wait a minute, what's this? Status equals progress? Never heard of it. Well, apparently, it's a new thing that dd does. If you pass status equals progress in your command, then it will show you a status line. Now, this is, as Cobra 2 pointed out to me the other day, this is the old behavior of if you wanted a status, you could do kill USR1 and then whatever the PID is to the PID of DD is, which you now know how to find because of the previous episode, and then it would show you the progress. But that's kind of, you know, if you didn't know to do that, maybe it's not so easy. So status equals progress, that's pretty easy. The thing is, you just have to know that it's there. And I think this is one of those features that has been a long time coming. It's kind of insane to me that it only just made it into DD. And I'm not really sure how far back it goes. I feel like I found it just the other day. And I felt confused. I was wondering if it had just been there for additions and additions and I'd never noticed, or if it was a brand new thing. And I haven't bothered hunting it down because I don't feel like it's that important to know the origin of this feature. Point is, you should know about the feature. Now you do. Status equals progress. Let's talk about software evaluation. Something that I want to talk about because none of us do it properly. I mean, some people do. Some people get paid for it. I mean, it's a job. It's something that you can become good at and do for money, like as part of a project management sort of role where you evaluate software and make sure that it is suitable for the task. But a lot of us don't do that. We forget about that part because it's not all that exciting. It's a lot less exciting than finding a software that promises to do lots of cool things and make your life super, super easy. And you kind of just jump on board because you assume everything you're seeing is either true, or to be a little bit more forgiving to the software developers, you are reading it through a certain lens of whatever your expectations may be. So if something, for instance, says it's going to make software video and audio conversion simple, then you might think, oh wow, that's fantastic. I'm going to drag and drop a file into it. It's going to convert it into exactly what I want, and then I'll walk away. Whereas I might look at that and say, oh, cool, it's going to be a command that I can use to maybe generate some presets with all the different settings that I personally prefer, and then invoke those each time or something like that. You know, we may both have a different interpretation of what a software is advertising. So communication breakdown sometimes happens. The important thing, though, is to evaluate software before you jump on board its bandwagon. And like I say, it's a little bit difficult to remember to do that, but it is important, and not only for ourselves, but I think for others. If we go to people and hand them software that we have reason to believe may solve the problem that they're seeking to solve, we're doing them a disservice if we haven't actually investigated whether or not the software will solve the problem they are seeking to solve. In fact, I think in many cases we're doing more harm than good, because when you give someone something without sort of evaluating it first, you're kind of wasting their time. I feel like you're probably damaging your own reputation, and possibly, you know, depending on the situation, possibly the reputation of, broadly speaking, open source. You know, if assuming that someone may not know what open source is, and you say, here's a great open source software that claims to do exactly what you said you wanted to do, and you haven't even looked at it, and then you hand them the thing, and it's a complete mess, then, I mean, I would probably argue that doesn't help open source in any way. I mean, it's just kind of like not putting your best foot forward, right? So software evaluation is important, and there are some steps that we can take. We can make it very, it is a, you know, it's a scriptable thing. It's something that can be automated, except it can't really be automated. I mean, it could be, but we're not doing that. But you know what we've got certain things that we can say that we need to do in order to evaluate a software. So let's talk about those things. The first thing that we should make sure that we should look at when we're looking at a software that we may want to adopt for ourselves or push over onto someone else, it actually It's something that we must do before we even find the software that we're proposing on. It's something prior to evaluation of software. It's evaluating your need. What key features are required in whatever software you end up using? You need to sit down with a whiteboard or a piece of paper, a legal pad, you know, whatever, however you're going to do it, word processor, Emacs, whatever. Sit down, have a cup of coffee on hand, and, oh, that wasn't a cue to go get coffee. I was just saying that sort of setting the mood, but we'll get coffee later. Don't go anywhere. And evaluate the needs of your of what task you want to accomplish. What do you need? What tools do you need to get from A to B or Z, or wherever you're going? And it certainly helps. Sometimes, first of all, sometimes that seems like a gargantuan task to people. They think, well, I can't possibly delineate everything that I need to have happen in order to get from here to there. And of course, that's not true. It just feels that way. So if you have to, you can do it in sort of a flow chart, you know, kind of like sort of a reverse flow chart is how I could envision it. But you can do it however you want. But I'll give this as an example. Just have your big goal, the task that you want done, up at the top. So that's the thing. And then from there, you might have a couple of broad steps, just sort of broad strokes for these things. Just, okay, so in order to, you know, edit video, then I need this, this, that, and this. Okay, got it. Well, wait a minute. What's in those? So then you go further down. So you're basically making sort of a family tree almost that just kind of keeps descending and descending into finer and finer detail until you actually do have a list of everything that you need a software to do. It doesn't have to be a chart if you're more comfortable with a bullet list or whatever. You can do that. Or it doesn't even have to be structured. You can just brainstorm. Just think of all the things that you expect this software that you imagine that you may use at some point. What are the features that you need? And there's no reason yet to limit yourself to what features you actually need. So once you have a big list or a big collage or however you decide to write it all down, once you've got that down on paper or whiteboard or computer screen, then go through them again and, you know, circle the necessary ones, the ones that are actually required in red, and circle the ones that are just kind of nice to have in blue, or whatever, you know, like put a check mark by the ones that are required, however you want to do it in whatever medium you're using. And so this is kind of a twofer. It's what, two for one. Before evaluating software, before finding your potential software, come up with a list of the things that you need and the things that would be nice to have. And you do have to learn to recognize which is which, and that is difficult for some people, because a lot of people's need list is exactly the same as whatever they are used to using already. The one that is going, that is about to be in end of life on them, or the one that they no longer can financially afford to purchase, or whatever their problem is, whatever is not working on their new platform when they left their old platform. You know, whatever the situation is that you're looking for software, a lot of times you base your, well, I have to have this, just purely based on what you used to have, without realizing that in order to get the job done, maybe those aren't needs to haves. And I think, honestly, I think that's one of the biggest blockers to open source or Linux adoption. But honestly, it's even a blocker to diversity among proprietary software. Because you might remember back in the 90s, there wasn't just one Photoshop, for instance. There were a bunch of applications that were sort of doing digital imaging. It was a fairly, I mean, I wouldn't say hugely rich space of competition, but there were some major contenders. And people just, I mean, they got used to one thing, they got taught one thing in school, and they just would not stray. And that's, it's a weird thing where people learn one thing, and that becomes their list of must-have features, down to the location of the buttons, you know? Like, well, the toolbar's over here, and I was used to it over here, so that's not going to do it for me. Or the keyboard presses. Well, on this platform, V was the move tool, and now you're telling me M is the move tool? There's no way I can adjust to this. So really making yourself, if you want to be happy in some new solution, really, really, really delineate between this is a required feature and this is a feature that I would really prefer, but I can see how that doesn't, if that feature's not there, I can see how I can still get this job done. Okay, so that's the first thing that you do. The next thing you do I think, is find the software. Now we're in the true evaluation stage. You find the software and you look at it and you think and you find out, does it do everything on my need list? And in order to do that, you probably have to do some kind of Hello World kind of project. Hello World in programming, of course, is that kind of classic, okay, here's how we write a program to usually to echo or to print on the screen the literal phrase, Hello World, but it's not always a literal Hello World. It could be something, you know, if it's a shader or something, it could just be, here is how you apply a standard, you know, or a non-standard, a red shade to an object in 3D space. This is your Hello World. It's just the bare minimum. And so if that's what you have to do for your software evaluation to make sure that it does all the things that you have on your need, your must-have list, then do that. So in other words, make sure that the project doesn't go, it doesn't take you any more than an afternoon, you know, especially on your first pass. This is purely to see if the application, honestly, what it really is, it's evaluating to make sure that the software does what it claims to do. Because presumably you wouldn't be evaluating the software if it didn't claim to get to the point where you want to be. If this isn't the software that is going to help you accomplish your task, you wouldn't be evaluating it. So right now you're really just making sure that they're not talking crazy, that they actually do mean that you can get from here to there. But on the other hand, assuming that the software can do what it claims to do, then as you progress, it starts to do a double, it does double duty as okay, does this software do what it claims to do, and can I get there by the avenue of my required list of features? And just take it from a blank document or whatever, or blank workspace to a finished project. Bare minimum. Just make sure that it does, that the workflow is something that you can deal with. And this may require some adjustment to your required list, because as you go, you might find, well, this thing I had marked down as required, and now I'm realizing that actually it's not required. I could work around that, or I can live without that feature. And maybe there's something on your nice to have list that you're realizing, going through this thing and not having this feature that I thought wasn't essential is making my life really, really difficult. I'm not so sure if I'm sold on this. So these are malleable lists. You can change them. You can adjust them as you evaluate. That's fine. Now, a part of that, or something that will probably emerge from that process, are some pragmatic concerns. For instance, what formats does the software export to, or save to, or whatever? What does it output for you? And the reason that this will probably emerge from this Hello World evaluation is because some of your must-haves you might find that there are workarounds for some of those must-haves, as long as you can get your project out of one, or your data out of one software and into another. You can maybe design a little bit of a round trip or a pipeline by which this one software that does do everything that you need except that one thing, well, you can just send it out to this other thing and then bring it back in. Or you can just, okay, that's where this software ends and that's where this next software will begin. So instead of having just one application that you open for this task, you have two now. It's not that big of a deal. And it's pretty common. It's even common, in the proprietary world, where you might have something happening in one software, and maybe there is functionality for it in this software, but it's not the best, and there are better applications designed for that thing, and so you use some kind of interchange format or an export format that you can then import into your next software and open it, you know, bring that data in and adjust it or modify it or whatever you need to do, or convert it, you know, whatever. And in open source, it's the same thing. I mean, in open source, I think a lot of people kind of like to imagine that it happens even more because open source is supposed to be modular. And I don't know if that's, you know, in some commands and things like that. Yes, I believe that is accurate. But in the big GUI applications where things are kind of, you know, like a word processor, or yeah, I guess it would be or an office suite, I guess, where instead of just being a word processor, yeah, you have like your spreadsheet, which maybe feeds data to your database. I don't know how these things work. I'm not really an office suite kind of person, but you know what I mean? Like even the open source applications, the GUI ones, they tend to be fairly monolithic. So I'm not sure how different it really is between open source and proprietary software. But the point is that you want to make sure that the software that you are using can get your data out of it. And it's not just for interchange, you know, or for pipelining or whatever you want to call it, round tripping. It is also a pragmatic issue of what's your escape route. If this software stops being supported by its developers and no one else picks it up, or if you decide that it's been good for 3 months and now you realize that wasn't the right choice after all, even though you evaluated it, how do you get your stuff out? How's that going to happen? Is it friendly to exporting your data? It's important. It's usually pretty good in the open source world, I have to say. But I mean, sometimes if it's a very specialized format, it just might not matter that much. It may not, you know, as friendly as the thing may be to exporting or to letting you access your data, it might just be so completely different, such a completely different paradigm that, you know, exporting it might be very, very difficult. Okay, and then next, related to that, is what formats can this application open? That's always important. It's important, at least for me, because I always find myself getting data from unexpected places. I'm always digging up data from here or there, or I'm being handed data from here or there, and I'm just thinking, wow, this format did not exist for me until just now, and now I'm learning that it does exist, and I need to find something that will open it, possibly convert it. Be open, obviously, to conversion, because sometimes, yeah, maybe your thing won't open it, but maybe there's a really simple command out there that will convert it for you, and then your application of choice will be able to open it or import it or whatever. So that's a it's it might be a little bit of, you know, some homework, and I feel like, once again, comparing open source to proprietary, which I'm not really sure why I'm doing that, but it just seems like a salient point. The open source tends to have converters down a lot better than proprietary, because I don't feel like proprietary providers really ever want to encourage the idea, the very thought, that you would be straying outside of their club for anything. And it's one of the most obstinately destructive attitudes, and they've hung on to it for a very long time. I mean, it was one of the many reasons that I left proprietary software was over format problems, or yeah, I guess format problems, being able to import and export and share data, or to get my data at all sometimes. Of course, on the other hand, I made a lot of money converting things for people because they couldn't convert their stuff with proprietary software, so that was nice. Oh, hey, I think I hear. Yes, I do. I hear the coffee music. So why don't you go get yourself a cup of coffee? I'll go get one for myself. We'll come back and talk more about software evaluation. Right, you're back. I'm assuming you have coffee. I can't see you, but I'm assuming you've got coffee. I'm trusting you to have gotten some coffee for yourself. I got mine. So we'll continue. Before the coffee break, I was making a snide remark. Whenever that .docx thing happened, I was at that point, it was good for job security, just being the only one at the time for that brief time where no n like even. What was it? I think it was the Mac version of Office could not open .docx's yet because the Windows Office and Window not Windows Mac and Office on Mac, and they were getting documents from people who were on Windows on Office, and they could not open them. And it was fantastic because I had this clever trick that I would do called Open Office, and it would just convert the things really, really easily. I don't remember if Pandoc was a thing that I was using at that time, or if it was even ex it might not even existed at that point. I don't remember, but yeah, it was good, and it was also good for Open Office. It was great for Open Office adoption in that particular organization, because I was able to just say, hey, look, this application, that opens these .docx's, so why don't you just start using that? And a lot of people actually did, because they didn't really use Office that much, to where something similar wasn't good enough. So that kind of leads me to the question of, when you're evaluating software, of asking, what are the support options available? And when we say support options, a lot of us, I think, just, I don't know why, but I feel like a lot of us think, well, that means that you can pick up the phone and there'll be a friendly operator on the other line, on the other end, who will be able to tell you how to do something. You know, it's like support, that kind of support. And I don't remember when on earth that's ever been a thing, to be completely honest with you. Maybe some of you do. I do not ever remember there being a support line for software. And maybe there was, and I never took anyone up on it, but I never heard of that in my entire life. So, but for some reason, I think that's what we all think support means. But, and I've had that. I mean, I have had that recently. Like, when you get a Red Hat license if you're running Red Hat on a server and you purchase the support contract, you do have first tier, or whatever they call the just a really basic, you know, you can call someone and they will answer your call and they will help you set something up, or they will try to help you set something up. And usually it's not a whole lot more than just someone looking at the same knowledge base that you are looking at in your browser, you know, and then if it becomes any more complex than that, then they have to elevate it. And so, you know, there's that whole tiered structure of support. And that's, I mean, that is what people, or partly what people are paying for when they pay for a subscription service. So it does exist, but I don't think that's not really what I'm saying. Support can also be something a little bit more broad, sort of like, okay, well, when I go to an internet browser and type in my problem, what kind of hits do I get? Has anyone else on the internet had problems with or questions about this software? Or am I looking at something that's really a niche thing that no one else is going to know anything about? Am I the trailblazer here? And I mean, if you are, maybe you're fine with that, but maybe you're not. And it's definitely something to consider. I mean, if you're the only one using something, then you're possibly, potentially a little bit out on your own. And you should also look at the project's support or their bug reports, you know, the wherever they keep their source code. Find that place. Find what kind of bugs have been filed. Find out if they're being responsive or not. It may or may not be a deal breaker for you, but just know that if it's something where there isn't a lot of evidence of interaction, whether it's among developers or just among other users, I mean, a lot of times the user interaction is just as good as developer interaction, because a lot of times, especially in open source, a dumb user isn't so dumb, and it might be that if they've been using it for 3 years and you're just about to start using it and you have some questions, then they can probably answer all of your stuff. They're that first level, that their first tier of support, right? But and even if there's something that seems like it would be a developer issue, it may not be. In open source, a user may be able to tell you exactly why something is happening, because maybe they know how to look at code and maybe you don't, and so they might be able to tell you, oh, well, that error indicates that there's a database problem and all you need to do is install this database instead of that database, or whatever, or give this user correct permissions, or, you know, whatever the problem may be. So support options, it's not just literal, like, is there a support line, because there's usually not. It's really more about, is there activity around this software online? Are there forums, or are there communities that are using that have been using this software for a long time that will be able to answer questions, and so on? Another question, more or less in this ballpark, it's not exactly related, but it feels similar. So another question to ask is, what platforms is this software available on? Now, if you've got a multi-platform, multiple OS work environment, then this might be something that you want to look at very early in the process. Or it might not be. I mean, if it's something where you have the ability to say, okay, all the people who need to use this software need to reboot their computer into their Linux partition and use it on there, or whatever. I mean, that was not uncommon at the movie studio that I used to work at. That was it wasn't on everyone's desk, but on certain people's desks where they needed, you know, some software that would only run on Windows, but they needed this one functionality, this one plugin that someone had written for this one thing, they would switch their computer over to the Windows box that was under their desk with their little KVM switch, and they would put the data on a network share and then import it back into the thing, run the plugin, and then put it back into the share, go back to their Linux box, and continue the workday. It was quite funny to see. I mean, it was that isolated, and it was simply because, yeah, there was some new thing that people were trying, and someone had written a plugin for one program that only ran on Windows, and so they had to buy a Windows license and a license for that one piece of software, grab that plugin, and use it for, you know, like, literally, it was like 5 minutes out of a day, once a week, but it was that important, and it saved, like, lots of man hours, so it was worth it. So yeah, maybe it's not that much of a problem, but maybe it is, depending on your situation. Luckily for me, honestly, lately that has not been a problem. It's not been an issue that I've had to think about. I am fortunate right now to be living in a pretty good Linux bubble, and have been for quite a while. But that's not everyone, obviously. So that may be a bigger deal to you than it is to me, but it is obviously something that's on my list, so there you go. It's important enough to acknowledge it. Okay, so the next thing that, again, kind of is in the same wheelhouse is the longevity forecast of the software that you're evaluating. And this is pure science fiction. This is something that you cannot know. This is just trying to be a fortune teller, really. But if you look at a project, at least you can get probably some sense of a temperature reading on its health. Has it been around for a long, long time as it is? Does it have a really big developer community such that if the lead maintainer just sort of walked away from it today, would the developer community behind it keep it going, or would it fall apart? It's really hard to tell. I think a lot of people have certain benchmarks or symptoms, I guess, that they look for to judge that. And I feel like I personally disagree with a lot of those benchmarks. You know, there a lot of times that it's sort of, I feel like, superficial things that maybe you look at it and you think, okay, well, yeah, that is a bad sign. But then you think, well, you know what? Maybe this isn't a bad sign for one reason or another. I'll use GitHub as an example. A lot of people, I feel, look at GitHub and make calls about projects based on GitHub activity. Now, the commit activity may be a good indicator, but the issue responses and how long a bug has been open and things like that, or how many bugs exist, some people really get worried if there are too many bugs in a project. I think, well, that's not a bad thing. That could be a good thing. I mean, it could be a bad thing. It could mean that a bunch of people are filing bugs and the developers aren't responding and aren't fixing them. But it also might mean that they've got a lot of involvement from their community and they're getting reports and feature requests. Maybe they're using their bug tracker for themselves to file issues, for themselves to do. So it looks like a bug to a cursory overview, but it's actually just a big to-do list of things that they plan on incorporating in the future. The commit history, even that, you can't really be sure because, I mean, if you're just looking at GitHub, are you sure that GitHub is the only place that they are committing to? You can't be sure about that. You would have to look a little bit deeper than that. So, yeah, there are some things where you can kind of look at them and just get this sudden gut instinct that could be entirely wrong. So, I mean, and I don't know how to say... I don't know what the right answer is on how to get a magical future forecast of how long the project will be around. But I think that if you kind of poke around and have a quick read over their mailing list or have a quick look at the bug trackers and look at their commits, see what kind of things that they're committing, both in their master branch and their development branch, things like that, you can get a pretty good feel for the project. Whether or not it's going to evaporate suddenly if it goes away, yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, that tends to be down to the immediate developer community. So if there's a project where it's just two or three lead developers, or maybe one lead developer, and there are a couple of people, and they add patches or they submit patches, and the developer commits or pulls in some, rejects some others, rejects a bunch of others. There's this thing about, like, those lead developers who are kind of leading their project with an iron fist, and you can kind of tell that it's being driven by one person. There was a screenplay writing application, actually, that was looking really promising, and it seemed to be going forward quite nicely. And I submitted a couple of patches to them. It was written in Python and WX, I think, WX Python. And so I submitted a couple of patches to them, and they rejected them for one reason or another, even though it was, you know, one of them was very validly fixing a problem that was keeping people from being able to use the software. The other one was it was fluff. It wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, it was something they'd asked for, but it was not essential. And they shot it down for whatever reason. And I got this sense that the lead developer was quite picky about pretty much everything. And sure enough, within about 2 or 3 years, the project had basically fallen dormant. I mean, it wasn't completely dormant. And it's not really around, actually. I guess if you ask the lead developer, it might still be around. But it's been forked off by some other developers who just eventually got tired of, which I sympathize with. I mean, if it's your software that you started, then that's it, you know, and you making it open source is great, because now other people can fork it if they want to. But it's just, I think that there's a danger when people are too protective over a project, because at some point when you run out of steam, no one's going to be around and feeling involved enough with the project to make sure that it continues, especially if they don't feel like you're going to be okay with changes that they make. Like, if you're sort of micromanaging every change, and even though you're not doing anything actively on the project, you're still rejecting all these changes because, hey, it's your project. So if you're not doing anything, no one's going to do anything. And that's pretty bad. And I've seen that. So you want to make sure that that's not happening with the software that you're looking at. And if it is, just be prepared for it to possibly fade away eventually, and hope that someone forks it, or possibly be prepared to fork it yourself and to get either your own energy and resources to make it continue, or be ready to hire someone else to take up the reins. Okay, so the next one is, what are the other options? So rather than looking at the software that you've identified as a potential key application for your workflow, look around, see what your other choices are. It might be that you don't have a lot of choices. It might be one of those limited spaces where maybe it's not exactly, there's not a whole lot of competition. That's a pity when that happens. It's you know, and I think it happens especially in the complex the application, I think fewer real choices you have. I mean, if you really think about, for instance, Audacity, which is an application I know and love, if I didn't like it, what would be my other choice, really, for that kind of quick audio wave form processing? Like, what would be the practical choice? I mean, really, it would be Ardour, I guess, but one could argue that that was overkill, and so you might think, well, what else is there? And there's really not. There's not a whole lot of competition. I mean, I can list other DAWs, but that same kind of quick and dirty workflow that Audacity has, it's kind of in a class by itself. I mean, there is another application out there that runs on Linux, but it's not open source, as far as I know. So there's no real reason to try that. But yeah, so my point being, there's some software out there that really, they don't have a whole lot of other choices. But it's important for you to know that's the case, you know, that you do have other choices, or that you don't have other choices, or that there's another choice on the horizon, but you can't really bank on those. So yeah, just kind of look around, see what your other options are, what other choices do you have. And again, I think that ties into some of the required versus nice to have requirements, because sometimes if you broaden the scope of your workflow, you might find that there are other options. And I think that's one of the hardest, psychologically speaking, that's one of the hardest things to adjust to. And I know it took me ages to adjust to the concept that there weren't certain, you know, there just weren't, certain things weren't the same way as they were on the thing that I was used to. And I think those those sort of prejudices form very early on. I mean, I hadn't been using audio editing software. I've used audio editing hardware. I've used samplers and things like that, hardware based, where you there is no screen. You know, you're doing it all just with buttons and playback and stuff like that. So the software that I was used to, I hadn't been using it for very long at all before I finally decided, you know what, I'm done with proprietary stuff and switched to open source. And it took me quite a while to adjust, strangely, to what I was finding on open source, because I'd just already gotten so used to the exact way that this other proprietary thing worked. And again, as I pointed out already, I think, if I had tried to switch to another closed source application, I would have had the same problem. So my point is not the difference between proprietary and open source. It is the propensity that I think a lot of us have to just latch on to the very first thing that we learn and to let it go very, very reluctantly. So looking at other options, it's difficult to let yourself do that and to redefine the thing that you are trying to achieve. But believe it or not, sometimes that makes for a better workflow. And that's it, I feel like that's probably one of those things that you have to experience in order to believe. And I probably wouldn't have ever believed anyone if they had told me, well, at some point in your life, you will be writing things in XML, styling them with XSL, and anything but that will seem inefficient to you. I would never have believed that, because number one, I wouldn't have known what XML at that time was. But, you know, it's just like, of course you can't do these kinds of things outside of a word processor. That's what a word processor is. Nope, actually there are these other things that they're called desktop publishers. Okay, well now that's the new standard for me then. So you can do that, but you could never do it with just text. And now of course I'm doing things with DocBook and XSL, and I cringe to have to go to anything else because it's just so time intensive and laborious, and it's just not as efficient for me. So yeah, looking around at other options, it is a good idea, however painful it may seem at the time. And then finally, last but not least, what does it take to get this software that you've been evaluating deployed and fully functional? And that seems almost trivial, I think. But and it may be, depending on what it is. I mean, if it was just Emacs, then yeah, maybe you're done. Maybe that was it. You're done. You install it, and now you're good to go. Who knows? But I mean, I don't know why I chose Emacs, because actually there's a lot of configuration in Emacs that you could possibly do. So whatever, though. But maybe it was Kwrite, and all of your boxen are running KDE. So it's super easy. But generally speaking, a new software is going to require some kind of setup, some kind of configuration. And if you're evaluating it on your everyday, your day-to-day machine, you probably don't realize the setup required. I've made this mistake several times. And I just forget that installing something and getting it configured and working perfectly on Slackware is a lot easier sometimes than on some other system. Most recently, the Love 2D game engine. I installed it on Slackware. I think I went into the Slack build file. I updated it to the latest, 11.1 or whatever it was at the time. I think it was 11.1. Installed it. I'm ready to go. Go to some other system, do the same thing, realize, oh, the repositories for this thing has 0.9 in it. Okay, well, gosh, all right. I could either write a .deb for 11.1, which I'm pretty rusty on, or maybe I could just switch to Fedora, because they're pretty famous about updating things. In fact, sometimes annoyingly so. So switch to Fedora on this particular machine. Install Love Game Engine. Oh, darn, it's only got 0.10. I need 11.1. Don't be confused by the zero dots. Love dropped the zero dot at 11, so it's two significant versions, or one significant version behind, depending on what you choose. And you're just thinking, well, now I have to go and package this thing, and then how long do I really want to have to support this package if I do write my own package? I mean, can I write the package now and just hope that the official repositories update eventually, and thereby rendering my custom package obsolete? It all depends. So, yeah, how long? What does it take? Does it take some weird dependency that you forgot you installed 3 years ago? maybe not 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and you're going to have to make sure that that gets onto everyone's system somehow? Is there some kind of configuration that you need to make it, make sure it gets standardized across systems? Are there formats that have to be converted in order for this thing to start being used? So in other words, get this thing up and running on some kind of clean install and see what the actual investment is when getting this thing going, deployed, whatever. It's something that I very frequently forget about and wish that I would not forget about. So I'm including it as the final item in this list. And that is everything. That's everything I can think of. There's probably, I mean, there are literally people who do this for a living. There are people who evaluate software for one reason or another. So there's probably something that I've left off. But I think this is a pretty good starter list or something, some stuff to think about when you sit down to evaluate some software to see whether or not it's something that you want to start using. And I mean, it's a heck of a lot better than opening up an application and clicking around, maybe adding an item or two to something in the application, and then just closing it and thinking, well, yeah, it launched. I clicked around. It didn't crash for a good 3 minutes. I assume it's exactly what I need, so I'll just start using it right now. Believe me, I know I've done that. I know my friends have done that. You've probably done it, dear listener. So I'm just saying it's important for us as smart computerists to give a little bit more thought into some of the stuff that we use, and certainly to give a little bit of thought into the things that we suggest for others to use. Because you've got a reputation. Open source has a reputation. So let's keep it clean. All right, thanks for listening. I will talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. That is spelled K-L-A-A-T-U. You can reach me by email, klaatu@member.fsf, as in freesoftwarefoundation.org. You can also find me on IRC, on the irc.freenode.net network, as not Klaatu. I'm usually in channels like Slacker Media and Ogcast Planet. Or you can direct message me, I have no problem with that. Finally, you can contact me on Mastodon. I'm on mastodon.xyz/@notklaatu.
Virtually dirt-free environment, Karen Shaw, several hours a week, gets her hands very dirty.